Let's jump in. Perek Yud Dalet is where we are at. Last week we talked about the beginning of the first couple of psukim and the introduction to the various themes of that it will unfold for us as the story continues. The relationship between Yonatan and Shaul, the challenges of Shaul. Good morning. Welcome back. Perek Yud Dalet. Which pasuk? I'm not sure yet. We're going to focus on two pasukim in particular, but just to kind of recap last week, we talked about the opening five pasukim that set the stage on various levels. Yonatan and his arm bearer, Nosei Kelav, decide to leave ranks of the army of Shaul and start a little activity of their own. Attack the Plishtim. And so we are told, as a kind of introduction, a number of pieces of information that Shaul had done so without his father's knowledge, which opens up the question of the relationship between Shaul and Yonatan. The notion that Shaul himself was sitting there waiting for something to happen, but nothing was going on. The Plishtim were on the attack already. And they have the Kohen Gadol. What role the Kohen Gadol will play, we'll see later in the story. And they decide to do a sneak attack up through the cliffs of the end of the Vadi to the two stones of Botzetz and Sena, and kind of surprise attack. And that brings us to Pasuk Vav. Vav and Zayin. Chet. And Tet. Vayomer Yonatan, hineh anachnu ovrim et ha'anashim v'niglinim aleihem. This is Yonatan's plan. So today we're going to spend a few minutes talking about the legitimacy of Yonatan's plan. Vayomer Yonatan, hineh anachnu ovrim el ha'anashim v'niglinu aleihem. Says Yonatan, listen, it's you and me against an entire army of Plishtim. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to sneak up on them, v'niglinu aleihem, and then we'll reveal ourselves to them, albeit at a distance. And they're climbing up the rock face. Im ko yomru aleinu, domu ad hagi'enu aleichem. If they say to us, be silent until we come to you, then v'amadnu tachtenu. Then we'll stand our ground. We won't go up. If they say the words Domu ad hagi'enu aleichem, wait, we'll come to you, then we are not going to attack. Whereas v'im koyamru, but if they say Alu aleinu, come up to us, then v'alinu, then we can go up. Ki nitanam Hashem biyadenu, God has given them into our hands. V'zelanu ha'ot. That will be for us like a sign. God, we'll make this kind of contract with God. We'll put the terminology in play. And whichever God wants us to do, he'll manipulate the circumstances so that the answer given by the Plishtim will reflect to us, will tell us what God wants us to do. And that's, in fact, how the story unfolds. So I want to spend some time today talking about these two psukim, Tet and Yud. Especially this phrase, V'zelanu ha'ot. The problem with this sort of deal that he makes, this contract, this kind of conditional statement. Is that in addition to the question of what it means and what the logic behind it is, it poses a very serious theological question. Now, Yonatan is not the only person in Tanakh to have made this kind of conditional agreement with God, if you will. The first instance that we have of a similar kind of if this person says this, then I'll know it's this, and if this person says that, then I'll know it's that. Right, that kind of Eliezer. Manipulation. First example would be Eliezer at the well. Right? When Eved Avram, who we know to be Eliezer, but his name is not mentioned actually in the parasha, when Eved Avram comes to the well, he also makes a very similar agreement, if you will, with God. And he says, God, I'm here as your servant. I'm here to serve Avram. I'm going to come to this well, and somebody's going to come out to feed their sheep. I'll come to the first girl I see, and we'll make the following deal. If I say to them, I'm thirsty, will you feed me? And she says, well, not only will I feed you, I'll feed your camels. Then I know that that's the one you've chosen for my servant, for my master, Avram. On the other hand, if she doesn't, then I'll know that that's not the one, and we'll go on, we'll move on. We'll go weiter, as they say. What's the problem? The problem is that in both of these instances we come dangerously close to what the Torah defines as a idolatrous practice.
Soothsaying? Not that I know what that is, but...
We're going to spend some time today talking about what it is. Okay, what it is and what it isn't. So, for this, I've prepared a bit of a source page for you. And I apologize that... the sources are, most of them are in Hebrew. There's one source in English, or two. Most of them are in Hebrew, but I will translate as we go. The story starts with the pasuk in Vayikra Perek Yud Tet. There's a prohibition in the Torah called Nichush. Lo tochlu al adam. In Vayikra Perek Yud Tet, which is Parsha Kedoshim, there's a list of mitzvot, one after the other, and sometimes you can have on one pasuk three or four different prohibitions or mitzvot or phrases. They're all very, very concise. All kinds of phrases. Lo tochlu al adam, cannot eat an animal with its blood. That's a separate prohibition related to kashrus. Lo tenachashu v'lo te'onenu. Now, Onen is a whole different piece. We're not going to get into it. But V'lot Nachashu is translated as you may not engage in soothsaying. What that phrase means, we'll have to look at. But that's the phrase. The word L'nachesh, right, in modern Hebrew means to guess. But that's because we've taken the substance out of the concept. Mm-hmm. So, whereas we attribute all of the ancient black magics to a kind of hocus pocus, so we assume that l'nachesh means to guess. Whereas in the arena of Tanakh, l'nachesh doesn't mean to guess, it means to derive information from obscure, what seemingly arbitrary sources. For example, who in Tanakh is most famous for, and this is a trivia question because we should all know the answer, most famous for the act of Nichush? And I'll give you a hint, it's in Sefer Bereishit.
The snake.
So the snake is called a Nachash, but Nachash and Nachash are actually two different things. One is a noun, one is a verb. They're actually unrelated. They come from different roots. But who is famous for the act of Nichush? It's actually two. One's more subtle, so we'll skip that one for now. But the one that's less subtle is.
Sarah?
Leah? Leah? Why would it be any of the women? Why would we assume such a dark...
Intuition.
We're not talking intuition, we're talking about dark black magic.
Oh, okay.
This is very dark, very
black.
Fortune tellers, okay? Fortune tellers, soothsaying, necromancers, all part of the same family of prohibitions.
They intuit certain things and then they basically take a an educated guess.
Well, that's modern thinking, okay? We're not talking modern thinking. We're talking about a world deeply stooped in the ideology of black magic.
Okay, so now we know it's not a woman. Let's see.
And the answer is the Viceroy of Egypt. Say it again.
Yosef.
Not Yosef as Yosef, but Yosef as the Viceroy of Egypt.
Yeah.
Okay. In other words, this is the irony of the situation, is that Yosef's playing a role.
From his interpretation of dreams,
right?
Nope. No. I'm looking very specifically for the term. I'm not looking for guests. Yeah. I'm looking very specifically for the term. So for this, we need to turn to the end of Parshat Miketz. Eric Mem Dalet.
And this one is 53.
What page?
53. Mem Dalet is 43.
So the brothers come down to Mitzrayim the second time, together with Binyamin.
44, rather.
And Yosef decides, now that they've got Binyamin there, he's going to do a little bit of a sleight of hand and stick the this famous cup into Yosef's bag, into Binyamin's bag. Take a look at Perek Mem Dalet. Pasuk. Let's start from the beginning of the Perek. Vayitzavet Asher al Beito Lemor, Malet Amtachot Anashim Ochel Kaasher Yuchlun Seet, Vesim Kesef Ish Befi Amtachto. The meal is over. He's sending them back to their father, and he tells his servants, "Go and refill their bags together with the money." And take my gold, my silver goblet, and stick it into the bag of the youngest. Morning dawns. They go on their way. They go out of the city just a little bit. They don't get very far. Yosef Amar Lasher al Beito. Yosef turns to his chief of staff and says to him, "Kum, radof achrei anashim, v'isagtam, v'yamarta lehem, lama shilamtem ra'at achat tova." Oh, chase after these people. Tell them, why did you such ingratitude? How could you have paid the kindness that I gave you? And he paid it with such evil. Halo ze asher yishte adoni bo, the very cup that my master drinks from, v'hu nachesh yinachesh bo, the cup with which he
divines.
Okay, divination, soothsaying, it's all part of the same family. Hareyotembo asher asitem. It's a terrible thing you've done. Okay. They go, they chase after the family, they catch them. Binyamin's bag is discovered as containing the silver cup. They come back to Paro's house, or to Yosef's house. Pasuk Yud Dalin. Vayavoy, towards the end. Vayavoy Yehuda ve'achav beta Yosef u'adenu sham vayiplu lefanav aratza. Yosef and his, Yehuda and his brothers, they've come to Yosef, they fall on their face. Vayomer lehem Yosef, ma ma'aseh zeh asher asitem? What is this that you've done? Halo yeda'atem ki nachesh yinachesh ish asher kamoni? You didn't think that somebody like me could divine what you had done? Do you hear it?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the act of nichush. Now, for the act of nichush, don't overlook the fact that what was needed was, or what was used typically, was some kind of object. Okay, in this case,
the goblet.
We'll see that that's a very important piece in the continuation. Now, That story continues, not that particular story, but the notion of Nichush continues into another part of Chumash, namely the brachas or klalos turned into brachas of Bila. So for that we need to jump to Bamidbar.
Herod. But here you don't really see him divining, you just see him saying that he does divine.
Correct. So the assumption is that he played the game for them. I'm not suggesting. That's why I said that the guilty party was the viceroy of Egypt, not Yosef.
But the divine,
right? It's a game. He's playing a game with them. But it's a game that's built around a culture that is very common in the Egyptian world and probably the ancient world altogether of this kind of divination, soothsaying, etc. What exactly it is we haven't defined. But I'm still working off understanding its role in Tanakh.
But can Nichush be for good or for bad? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, his ulterior motives were not the soothsaying. It was ulterior motives of Yosef. It was not bad.
The issue isn't Yosef's playing a role there. He's playing a game there. That's not the issue. The issue is that it's a practice. Whether it's condoned or not, we haven't gotten to yet. The Torah prohibits it. Mm-hmm. The Torah defines it as idolatry.
Okay.
Whether he engaged in it or not is irrelevant. I don't think he did for a second. I think it was all a game. But that's not the issue. The issue is that we see the term appear in the Torah specifically with regards to, in this case, Yosef, but he's playing the role of
the viceroy
of an Egyptian. In Parsha Balak, we have a statement, Perchav Gimel, Pasachav Gimel, amongst the brachas that Bilam offers regarding Israel. And it's again, it's a bracha, Perachav Gimel, Pasachav Gimel, 23:23. Amongst the brachas that he declares, remember, it's Bilam ben Bo'or HaKosem. Bilam is defined in the Torah as not so much a Navi, but a Kosem. A Kosem is a
magician.
In modern Hebrew, it's a magician. I'm not sure if the term fits in Tanakh, but it's amongst the families of activities of black magic. You have divination, soothsaying, necromancing, all kinds of different activities, and exactly defining what's what is really complicated conversation, but not for now. Bilam is defined as one of these experts, Bilam ben Bo'or HaKosem. So if you take a look at Perachav Gimel, Pasachav Gimel, you'll see that amongst the brachas he gives to Israel, Pasachav Gimel, is Ki lo nachash b'Yaakov v'lo kesem b'Yisrael. Ke'ed i'amar li'Yaakov l'Yisrael ma pa'al el. This people called Israel, they know what God does. They have the ability to know ma pa'al el, what God does, but without nachash and without kesem. Ki lo nachash b'Yaakov v'lo kesem b'Yisrael, ke'et y'amer li'Yaakov l'Yisrael ma pa'al el. Do you understand the context? Bilam's recognition of Israel was that they do not engage in nichush or ksamim. And similarly, it says of Bilam that, look at Perachav Dalid, Pasuk Aleph, the third time when Bilam saw that God really was going to insist that he bless Israel, Vayar Bilam kitov b'nei Hashem levrechet Yisrael, v'lo alach kefam befam likrat nechashim. Vayashet ribar alamid ba'panah. The first two times, in order to engage in this kind of activity of blessing, he had to go do whatever nichush is, whatever divination is, to try to figure out what God wants, some sort of activity with something. So he didn't do that this third time. So you get a sense that divination is an effort to try to, that's why it's called divination, right? To try to divine what God is doing or thinking or instructing, using some kind of exterior indicator. Right? Based on that, if you take a look at source 2, the Gemara states, Tanu Rabbanan, lo tenachashu v'lo te'unenu, כגון אלו המנחשים בחולדה באופות ובדגים. Classic example of this kind of divination are those who engage in it with menachashim, with weasels and birds and fish, animals.
What's a chuldah, fish?
Chuldah, no, chuldah is a kind of rodent.
Chickens?
Of is a bird. Of is shemayim. And dagim a fish. So in other words, a kind of they would use animals for this purpose. If you'll forgive me, not too dissimilar to the arena of, or to the concept of, modern times. A very famous rodent that's used for, or animal that's used for divination. Groundhog Day. Right?
Whatever.
Okay? The Groundhog Day. It's a classic example of divination. If you put stock in it, then you're guilty of idolatry. If it's a joke to you, then okay. So it's a similar, another issue. But that is, although it's a good movie, but that's a separate issue. But that is a, but that's what divination is. Now, where does life get more complicated? Life gets more complicated dealing with Eliezer and Yonatan. Because this seems to be an example of, although using some kind of external verbiage of a foreign, of an enemy, but it's an external factor, and based on that external factor, Zelenu Ha'ot, going to decide what it is that God wants of us, seems to be an act of divination. And in fact, that seems to be the way the Gemara defines it, which raises for us the question, how could they have engaged in activity which is prohibited? So take a look at the Gemara in Source 3. This is where the story begins. Until now, it's been an introduction. Once upon a time, Rav Havakazul lebei Rav Chanan Chatnei. Once upon a time, Rav was going to visit his son-in-law Rav Chanan. Chazei mivra dekaati laape. He saw a ferry boat carrying the family coming towards him. Amar, he said, Mivra ka'ati la'api yumatav l'go. If you see the ferry boat coming to you, that's a good sign. That's an omen. Believing in omens is complicated. That's exactly where this story begins. Omens, soothsaying, divination, it's all part of the same family. Believing omens, not a good thing. Azil kam abava, so he stood at the door to this ferry. Udik bibiza, bibiza de dasha, he looked through the crack of the door. Chasi chiyuta de talia, and he saw a piece of meat hanging. The way you would hang, right? You slaughter an animal and you hang the piece of meat. Taraf abava, he knocked on the door. Nafuk ata kuli amalape. And he was Rav, so he was the great rabbi, he was the head of the yeshiva. He knocked on the door, announced his presence, and everybody came running out to greet him, including Atit Tabachinami, including the chefs in the kitchen responsible for the meal. In the meantime, Rav is standing there, he's looking at this piece of meat, they're all coming out to greet him. La'alim Rav e'ne mine. And instead of looking at the people who are coming out to meet him, he didn't take his eyes off that piece of meat. Strange thing to do, right? Says the Gemara, Amar lahu, he then turned to the guests and said, Iko hashta, safitilu isura libne brat. If this is your conduct, then you are feeding my daughter's children forbidden meat. La achal rav me'ahu bisra. And he refused to eat of that meat. That's the story. So now the Gemara raises the question, what is going on? My timer, memtet, means my timer. What's going on? What is the reason? Why didn't Rav eat dinner that night? So there's several possibilities. Possibility number one, im ishum i'alume. Very important halachic principle, which has nothing to do with our discussion, but you just be aware of it, called basar shenit alem min ha'ayin. One of the complications in kashrus is that meat and fish, but meat in particular, once it's slaughtered and prepared, can never be out of your sight in order for it to be kosher. The moment meat is left for a second unsupervised, and unsupervised means not in your possession, or not in your visual field, or not sealed and stempled. That's how we sell kosher meat. We have to have it sealed and stempled with a double seal, etc. All kinds of halachic issues. But meat has a unique status called basar shenit alim min ayin. The moment it gets out of sight, we are choshesh that some rodent comes and switches the meat, and it has and it is forbidden. It has enormous ramifications for kashrus. It's one of the reasons why fleishchutz is a much more complicated kashrus to supervise than anything else. Okay, that's just FYI, it's out there. So it says the Gemara.
Suzanne would be saying, you see,
right. Yes, she would. Imishum ialume, if it's because it was out of sight, ha lo ialim. It's not true. It's true that chefs came running out to meet him. He was very upset about that, but he kept his eye on the meat, so at least somebody was supervising it. So therefore, that shouldn't be an issue. Ela de nachish. But rather, he felt that it was because of the omen. Evidently, meaning that he caught himself in thinking, or they said, or something happened in that statement where he says, oh, if the fairy comes out to meet you, that's a good omen, that was an act of nichush. Act of nichush is idolatry. If it's idolatry, then everything becomes prohibited and benefit, complicated, says the Gemara, but that's not true either. Why not? Listen carefully. V'ha'amarav, Rav himself, the same Rav, is quoted as having taught the following statement. Kol nachash she'eno ke'eliezer eved Avram b'chiyonatan ben Shaul, any omen defined in a manner that is different from the form declared by Eliezer, servant of Avram, or Yonatan, son of Shaul, eno nachash. It's not considered a nachash. Meaning, now the only real nachash is the kind that was done by Yonatan and Eliezer. Anything else is not real nachash. It's an omen. It's kind of like, you know, whatever. Irrelevant. That's insignificant. Serious. So, says the Gemara, there had to be a different reason for why he did not eat. It was a choice meal. It was a meal of free choice, and Rav did not partake in meals of free choice, meaning Rav had his own particular chumrah, then he didn't eat meals during the week unless they were obligatory. He would nash, he would eat little pieces of morsels, but he wouldn't sit down to a full meal unless it was a suras mitzvah or a surat Shabbos yata. That's the conclusion of the Gemara. It has nothing to do with omens, etc. Okay, albeit.
He was skinny.
Park all that aside, what's the takeaway vis-a-vis our discussion? The statement of Rav that the quintessential, the paradigmatic example of Nichush is the formulation of Eliezer and the formulation of Yonatan, which, says the Gemara, seems to fall into the category of Nichush, which raises a very difficult problem for us. So, Mela Eliezer Eved Avram, I could argue, maybe, that even though it was Nichush, and it was Nichush, I'm not bothered by it so much because he really was a Gentile. So he may have grown up in Avram's house, but for all intents and purposes, culturally, he came from a foreign place. But Yonatan ben Shaul is Yonatan ben Shaul. That's a harder one. Add to that the fact that in both cases, God responds to this ot in a positive way, and there's no hint in the Torah or in the Navi that there's any criticism of them for it.
Or a bad repercussion.
Right. Is it chilly in here? Am I the only one?
Yeah, it's chilly. You're not the only one.
Yes, it's chilly.
She's got a coat on.
That's an
outfit. Oh my God! Look at you wearing a sweater. Maybe I should loan. Oh my God! Maybe I should loan you my coat.
It is 7:71, so we should be
alright.
Okay. So to understand, so this is essentially the sugya. It's a halachic sugya. It's a halachic discussion in the Talmud and all the Rishonim on this passage in the Gemara. It's also a Tanakh issue because we need to understand what Yonatan was doing.
is Yosef in the meantime?
I'm not bothered by Yosef.
Oh, okay.
Because Yosef was playing the role of an Egyptian.
It was his public.
Yosef was playing the game.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So he's playing the game, doesn't bother me.
Okay.
Right? Okay. And that Bilaam engaged in it is no surprise. Right. But the Torah prohibits it as an activity. The Torah blanketly prohibits the act of nichush.
For Jews.
For Jews. Okay.
What about non-Jews?
Not yeah, prohibited.
So what's the difference? I don't actually understand why it's divination, because they're not predicting. They're just saying, if this happens, then I'll do this, and if this happens, I'll do this.
That essentially is what prediction is. That is essentially what the divination is. So, example.
But is that the same as saying, getting up in the morning and saying, well, if the sun is out, I'll go to the beach, or if it's raining, I'll go to...
So there are Rishonim who say that that's exactly true, except that... correct. Like, that's exactly what the distinction we're going to have to figure out. Where is the boundary between logical deductions based on circumstances versus nichush? Okay? But for now, at face value, we'll modify this in a second, but for now, at face value, the Gemara seems to state that Yonatan's activity and Eliezer's activity both fall into the category of nichush. So we're going to have to figure that out.
Can I ask one question? This is very common. You get these chain letters online.
Yeah.
If you don't pass this on to 10 of your friends...
Yeah, it's pure spam.
Huh?
Pure spam.
Yeah,
it's a separate issue. It's a computer issue.
If people do that, if we follow it...
If you follow it, you're guilty of spreading spam. We'll report you to the authorities. Absolutely not. No, is it divination? It's a scam. Is it divination also?
If
you believe in it, it's a...
If you do it, then good things will happen.
Yeah.
You'll have $1 million in 2 weeks.
Right.
So if you believe it, it is divination.
It's a virus. It's a computer virus. And by sending it out, you are guilty of perpetrating the computer virus, because that letter is the virus. Yes, it fills the airwaves with mail that clogs the internet, and thereby preventing normal routine business from being able to operate at a regular pace, because the airwaves are filled with this garbage. You think just by sending it to 10 people it doesn't work, but that's exactly how it's designed to work. You multiply that by a factor of 100, right, and very quickly, you fill the airwaves with computer garbage. That's exactly how those things work. So, whether it's soothsaying or not, I couldn't tell you, but it certainly is computer viruses. All right, let's get back to the subject. So, there are essentially three different approaches to this issue in the Rishonim. I'm most interested in the third, which we'll come to, Bezrat Hashem, in a few minutes. To get there, we need to look at the other two. So, the first is Tosfot. Tosfot, the Ritva, the whole school of Rishonim who on this Gemara raise exactly this question. How is it possible to suggest that Yonatan ben Shaul is guilty of divination? That's Gevalt. Right? Mm-hmm. I don't need to translate Gevalt, right? V'chayotze bo Shaul, says Tosfot, v'im tamai hech nichesh, how is it possible that Yonatan can be guilty of nichosh? Says the Gemara. It says to us, "V'yesh lamar dilzarez et na'aro amar kein ubelav hachinami haya ole." Says Tosfot, Yonatan didn't really believe in it. He was playing it out for the benefit of his na'ar. But he himself knew, regardless of what the enemy would say, they would attack. The prohibition in Nichosh isn't a prohibition against engaging in the activity. It's a prohibition against believing in the activity. So on the Groundhog Day, when the groundhog pops his head out of the ground, and you say, oh, he sees a shadow, doesn't see a shadow, the prohibition isn't against watching the groundhog. The prohibition is against believing and acting based on what the groundhog does. Okay, that is essentially the issue. Says Tosfot, Yonatan clearly was playing a game for his na'ar, much as Yosef was playing the game in Mitzrayim, and he himself didn't really believe he was going to go up either way. So says Tosfot. Now, in the pshat of the perek, that's a hard interpretation to see in the story itself. Because the way it reads is that
it plays out.
It plays out exactly as Yonatan describes it, and the language here is very important. But that's what Tosfot says, and again, because of the difficulty of this question.
But it says Lizarez at Naro to inspire his armor bearer.
Right, because otherwise,
get him going.
Right, otherwise, for his Nar to follow him into the battle, when it's the two of them against the thousands of Plishtim, you need to either have incredible courage, incredible faith, or have your head read. One of the three. So this way, he had a way of kind of convincing him. So says Tos.
Do we know who his armor bearer is?
On the other side of the equation, I have the Rambam. And the Rambam, I'm going to skip the Ritva, because Ritva really says essentially the same thing. Just says it a little more dramatically. Chas leila avda de Avram de lahavi mechanachesh, chas v'shalom, that the Eved Avram should engage in menichosh. Eved Avram also, he says, was in the same thing. He wasn't really going to be samachanet. He really knew that he was looking for the first girl that would come out would be the one that Hashem would send him. It was a game he was playing. All right. More complicated. Let's look at the Rambam. Ein menachashin. Says the Rambam, this is in the laws of idolatry. You're not allowed to engage in this kind of divination. Ein menachashin ke'akum, shenemar lo tenachashu. Ketzadu anachash. What is the nature of this activity? So here, shall to come back to your question. What exactly, how do we define it? So this Rambam, I've included the translation of, so you have it. It's a very foundational piece. Kegon. Elu she'omrim ho'il v'nafla piti mipi o nafal makli miyadi en yolech l'makom ploni hayom she'im elech en chafzai na'asim. Somebody says, oh, my piece of bread fell out of my mouth and my staff fell from my hand. I'm not having a good day. Therefore, I'm not going to go on that business trip because I'm not having a good day. Things aren't going my way. I dropped my breakfast butter side down, I dropped my staff, I fell, this isn't my day, I'm going to cancel my business trip. That's nichush. Ho'il, or another example, ho'il v'avar shu'al mimini. This is a classic, right? The black cat syndrome. Okay? Path is crossed by a black cat, bad luck. Okay? Bad luck omens are part of this whole culture of black magic divination. Since a fox passed on my side, I will not go out my door today. Or since if I go out there, I'll meet the deceiver, right? If I go out, black cat in that direction, or walking under a ladder, or any of these kinds of omens of bad luck. Or, chayin, elu, sheshomim tzifzuf ha'of, v'omrim yiyakach, or yiyakach, tov lasot davar ploni, v'ra lasot davar ploni, or people who listen to the birds chirping and say, based on their chirping, this will happen, or that will happen, or they read the cards in this way or in that way, all of these things are part of the same family. Or those who say, slaughter this rooster, the crowed like a raven, slaughter this hen, the crowed like a rooster, all kinds of activities with animals. That's what the Gemara was referring to about the use of animals. Now look at the last paragraph. The chayin, similarly, hamesim simanim laatzmo im ya'are lo kach v'kach eseh davar ploni v'im lo ya'are lo eseh. If somebody sets for themselves up a sign and says, if this will happen, I'll do this, and if this doesn't happen, I will not do this. Ke Eliezer Eved Avram. Exactly like Eliezer. V'chein kol kayotze b'dvarim ha'elu, ha'kol asur v'chol ha'oseh ma'aseh mipnei dvar midvarim elu lokeh. All of these activities are prohibited, and anybody who does them is guilty of believing such omens and is a violation of a biblical commandment. So the Rambam takes this Gemara very straightforwardly and very literally, and says, if you rely on it, it is nichush, Eved Avraham is guilty of Nichush. By that token, I would have to say although he doesn't mention Yonatan, they're brought together in the same breath in the Gemara, guilty of Nichush, and we're done. Which is probably the most extreme position in this discussion. To which if you read the Rambam is a halachic treatise, so he takes all the statements of the Talmud, records them, reorganizes them, and relates them almost verbatim in the language of the Gemara, although he translates them all into Hebrew. And on the paragraph by paragraph, there was a critique of the Rambam written by a Rishon Lehem of the Ravid. And the Ravid writes of this Rambam, the source 8, Efshar, Omer Avram, Avram, even though, says the Ravid, Ze Shibush Gadol. This, which the Rambam just wrote, is a great mistake. Sharei davar ze mutar. This is certainly permissible. Mutar mutar. V'ulai teo lashon shara kol nachash enok yaliezer v'yonatan eno nachash. Maybe the Rambam misread the Gemara. He saw the Gemara that says that eno nachash, which is any nachash which is not like Yonatan and Eliezer, is not nachash. V'hu suvar shel inyan isra nemar. He thought that the Gemara meant that that's what's prohibited. V'ulai ela achikama eno ra'oi lismoch. It means that if any nachash that isn't like the nachash of Eliezer or like Yonatan isn't going to work, and therefore it's not worthy of your time or attention. Gemara is not saying it's prohibited. Gemara is saying it's nonsense. If you want a real omen, then you got to go to the kind of omen that Eliezer articulated, or the kind of omen that Yonatan articulated. That works. Everything else is nonsense. That, says the Ravid, is how to read the Gemara. And the Rambam got it backwards, he says. Instead of saying that this kind of activity that Yonatan and Eliezer were engaged in is the only one worthy of activity because it's the only one that works, the Rambam saw that as saying they're the ones that are prohibited. Says the Ravid, I've got it backwards. So you understand the extreme positions here. We go from absolutely prohibited to absolutely permissible and worthy, and the only kind of real omen that's of worth, all because at the centerpiece of this discussion stands two biblical stories which we attribute typically to people who are role models for our religious ideology. So it's a complicated piece. There's a third school of thought, actually four, but I'm going to skip number four because I don't think we'll have time. But there's a third school of thought, which I think actually probably comes closest, in my humble opinion, not that I have the ability to put my head into this discussion, but I think comes closest to the mark in the story itself. It's actually quoted by the Shulchan Aruch, it's quoted by the Beit Yosef, so this becomes normative halacha because the Beit Yosef quotes it. But it comes from a Rishon called Rabbeinu Nissim or Chidush Eran, source number 9. Says the Ran, and this is very important for us.
Mikom, so it says it's based on the Rambam.
No, it's the Kesef Mishnah al Rambam. The Kesef Mishnah is a commentary on the Rambam written by Rav Yosef Karo, who's the same author as the Shulchan Aruch.
Right.
So it's written, it's quoted by Rav Yosef Karo.
The layers are coming
the heating, off. The heating says 71. I can't do anything about it.
The air coming in from the windows is very frigid.
Whatever.
Umikom akom, hadavar tzirich tirutz. She'i efshar shetzadikim alalu havu menachashim. This needs some explanation. It's not possible, like he says, this is the Ran and quoted by Rav Yosef Karo, so this is not possible to live with the implication of the Rambam that these great tzadikim, Eliezer and Yonatan and Shaul, were guilty of nichush. This is my understanding of the factors, and this becomes very important for us. Shehanachash she'asrat Torah. When we talk about the kind of divination that the Torah prohibits, hu hatole et dvarav b'siman she'ein hasvara notenet she'ehe behem gorem to'elet l'davar onezek. It's when you apply your action or to make your actions dependent upon an outcome of something which has no logical connection to the activity at hand. You throw a coin to decide your fate. Right? So this groundhog that pops his head out of the ground has no logical connection to, sees a shadow, doesn't see a shadow, relevant to what the rest, to what you're going to do the rest of the next couple of weeks. If you make your actions dependent upon a activity which is totally arbitrary, the bird chirping, with the bread falling on the ground, butter side up or butter side down, I'm bad luck today, then your actions are dependent upon something which is totally arbitrary. How much luck you're going to have? How much luck you're going to have is not a Jewish concept. Ein mazal Yisrael. We are under divine providence, and that's prohibited. Kugon, says the Ran. For example, Pito nafal miado, the first case, the bread fell down. Vitzvi yiftzik lo baderech, or a deer that crossed his path. Kedita beperek dalet mitot she'ele v'chayotze behem hemi darkeha emori. These are idolatrous black magic examples. However, halokech simanim b'davar she'asvara notat she'en morim to'elet ha'davar onizko. If you're looking to do something and you see something which is logically connected to your outcome, to your activity, it's a nachash. She'chol iskei olam kach. That's not nachash. That's the way of the world. Haresh omer she'im yerdu gshamim lo etzei l'derech. If a person says, you know, if it's raining, I'm not going out today. That's not nachash. Im lav etzei l'derech, right? You get up in the morning and you don't know what the weather's going to be like, and you say to yourself, okay, if it rains, I'm going to go outside. So this is the example you gave, right? If it rains, I'm going to go outside. If it's not raining, if it rains, I'm not going to go outside. If it rains, I'm going to go outside. No, other way around. Whatever. Right. You got it.
We got it.
Right? So that's not nachash, because the test parameter is logically connected to the outcome.
To your behavior.
You're applying logic. You're not applying
magic
or reliance on
caution.
Right. That's normal, normative. So now let's go back to the stories of Eliezer and Yonatan. And this is where our story gets very important. Eliezer Eved Avram v'Yonatan ben Shaul v'chayotze mizeh talu ma'asehem. This is exactly the behavior of Eliezer and Yonatan. Sheliezer yodea haya shelo ayum zuvagin isha liyitzchak avinu elo hogenet lo. In Eliezer's case, what did he divine? What did he create? He created a test. But the test wasn't arbitrary. Had the test been arbitrary, Eliezer would have said, you know what, God, we're going to make a deal. The first girl who comes out, if she has red hair and is 5'11", that's the girl for you. That's the proof that you've given me the right girl for Yitzchak. Okay? That would be arbitrary, and that would be divination. But the test that he designed was specific to the character of the girl. That's not divination. That's what he's looking for. His test was the test of character, that she should be nice and kind and considerate about chesed. He's going to ask for water. She's going to give him water and his animal water. That's not a divination. That's looking for shidduch. If it's an arbitrary mazel luck type of thing, you know, God, the third person to come out the door is going to be the person who's going to be the right one, and I'm going to count them 1, 2, 3. That's divination. But logic, outcome, is not. We have to come back to Yonatan, because that's where our whole story is. Yeah, but you had a question.
Doesn't it also, like, reinforce that everything happens for a reason, like God brings these things? It
depends on what the issue is. Right? If it's a function, if it's logical, then yeah, but you can't rely on... You cannot rely on arbitrary simanim. You can't say, okay, the third person to come out of the door is going to be the shidduch for Yitzchok, and then count them and say, well, it must be for a reason. If that's the person that came out of the door third, it must be the one for God, for Yitzchok. Right? That's playing God. Okay. We can't play God. That's black magic.
Okay.
Right? We can't divine. That's why it's called divination. We are setting the tests for God to fill in.
Okay.
Doesn't work that way.
So what about when people say, oh, God forbid somebody passes away, then and somebody else, you know, like out of their time and, you know, tragedy, and they'll say, oh, that person must have sinned, or they have to have a reason why this bad thing happened, so they make things up.
That's a completely different subject.
But I mean, it's still...
That's pure idiocy.
Still pretending that
that's pure idiocy. And anybody who says that to somebody needs their head read.
But people say things like that.
Yeah, well, people say very, very mean things in a non-meaning, in a way that is non-intentional.
I have very strong feelings about that. I would like you to turn that off, because I just want to tell you.
Back to Yonatan Ben Shaul. And here's the critical piece. V'Yonatan ben Shaul shebikesh lahakot b'machane plishtim. When Yonatan ben Shaul wanted to engage the plishtim, v'hu nasek kila bilvad, and he and his nasek kilav alone, l'kach v'zeh siman la'atzmo, he made this following sign. Now this sign, up until now we've assumed, based on the sugyo or the Gemara, that this is an arbitrary language, arbitrary siman. Says the Ran, and this is the piece, all of this is related to the story, says the Ran, no, it's not arbitrary. There's a strategic logic to his test. And the moment there's a strategic logic to it, it comes out of the realm of omen, or ot, or nachash, and into the realm of military strategy. What's the logic? Now, the Ran's interpretation of the logic is as follows. She'im yomru, alu aleinu. If they'll say to us the words, alu aleinu, come up to us, that means, says the Ran, yehinir'ah shehem yu'im ma'arav, that they are afraid of an ambush. And the reason they're not coming down to us is because they're afraid we're going to ambush them. So therefore, they're asking us to come up to them. But if they're afraid of an ambush, it means that they are an army that is in fear. And if they're afraid, if they're on the defensive, and therefore they're afraid of an ambush, then we have the upper hand, and even though we're only two, with God's help, we will be victorious, because between our strength and courage and the Ribbono Shel Olam's help, if they're afraid, we have that moment of advantage to take, the moment to take advantage of. It's possible for two or three courageous soldiers to take out a large group of soldiers who are afraid in their very nature, who are fearful. Whereas, if they say, stay your ground until we come to you, then you, I mean, divrei shein amit pachadim. Then we can see that they're not afraid. That they're not afraid. That they're courageous. We're coming to you. They're not afraid of being ambushed. Then lo hayara uili Yonatan ben Shaul sheim soratzmo l'sakana. Then it would be stupid to put yourself in danger and go on a suicide mission. Minhago shel olam. How he gets back to the Gemara in Chulin, I'm going to skip for now. I want to come back to our sugya, and that's essentially where the Ran leaves it. That all of this is about strategy. That this test that he offers, and Eliezer as well, it's not about nichush and signs and omens and good luck charms and all of these things that are rabbit's foot and all of these things fall into the category of nichush. That is not the case. What you have is a pure strategic decision. The only modification that I would offer is that there's another way of looking at the strategic analysis. Meaning, what's Yonatan's logic? So the Ran's logic is that the language, Alu Aleinu versus Domu Ad Gienu Elechem, come to us versus we'll come to you, is a litmus test for how fearful the soldiers are. If they're willing to come to us, that means that they are fearful. They're not fearful. Where if they ask us to come to then come to them rather than coming to us, that means that they are fearful of a ambush. I would shift that focus a little bit. Because in a military context, if you are standing guard at the edge of the camp and you see from a distance unidentified soldiers, what is your typical, normal military response, assuming that you are a trained army or conducting yourselves in a proper fashion? What should your normal response be? You see unidentified people in the distance. You are on guard. What is your normal military response supposed to be?
Go tell somebody?
No, you are the guard.
Don't you just tell them put your arms up and come to you?
You normally if they're approaching, normally you say to them,
Stop.
And then and if you don't know who they are,
identify,
then you ask them to identify themselves, friend or foe. Classic example, Yoshua and Yericho, right? We sees the malach with a soldier, sees an ish with the sword drawn, and he says to him, "Alanu atayim mutzareinu, are you friend or foe, for us or against us?" Okay? If the plishtim are standing on the cliff and they see two soldiers, unidentified, let's assume for the moment in the darkness of the morning dawn, coming out from their hiding place, and they say to them, "Alu eleinu, come on up," then to Yonatan's read of the Plishtim's camp, what does that indicate?
They think that they're friends.
Either that they think that they're friends or that they're not organized in a proper military fashion. Proper military response would be, Domo ad agienu alechem. Cease, stop, identify yourselves. Password, friend or foe, who are you, what are you, right? Don't let an enemy get close to your camp before you stop them and identify himself. Right? This, unfortunately, the Israeli army today has learned very well, has always known, but it's learned even more significantly in the era of suicide bombers. Because if you let them get too close, it's too late. So you have to identify them at a distance. So domu ad agienu alechem, stop until we come to you, is a military readiness that bespeaks of an organized army. That, Yonatan says, two of us are not going to take out an organized army. But his suspicion is, as we've already identified, his suspicion is that the Plishtim army is not an organized army. It's a group of mercenaries from all kinds of different sources, including Ivrim, who have been coerced into their service. And all that he really wants to do is create confusion in the ranks. If the litmus test is the konanut, is the readiness of the guards. If the readiness of the guard is such that they're sleeping on their job, and they see two Ivrim, and they say, a bunch of Ivrim coming out of their holes, and hey, come on, let's talk strategy, let's see what's going on. Right? Then they know that these guys are not really a ready army, and then the two of them can create a surprise attack. A surprise attack will create confusion. And they're counting on that confusion to then be able to turn and run, and they're not looking to conquer the Plishtim. They're looking to start the campaign, create confusion, and run.
And demoralize them.
demoralize them. And they can do that if the plishtim aren't ready. If the plishtim are ready for a fight, then they're going to turn them around. And that, I think, is the strategy behind Yonatan's argument and why it doesn't fall into the category of Nachash, because it's a military strategy, it's a logical strategy, and not an arbitrary omen that would fall into a different context. So that's the observation, that's my modification on the Ran's insight, but I think it's very important because it has ramifications for everyday life. What is Nachash and what isn't is a question we go through in our decision-making process every day. It's what kinds of things we rely on versus what kinds of nonsense of luck and other stuff that has infiltrated in today's culture that we really need to be aware of and stay away from. Okay? We will adjourn here. And...